This week on COINTELPRO, we take on conservatism for the first time with our friends at The Federalist. We've mostly reserved our powder for liberals, capitalists, and others to our more immediate right. This week, the neocons tell us about the difference between eco-terrorism and recycling. Then Joy Pullman reassures us all that the gates of hell have in fact opened, and it's time to put your demons back in the closet.
Oh my gosh. So I guess my question is, like, how popular is The Federalist?
Well, that's the thing, is that it's one of these that absolutely could not exist on its own sort of like market value. These things are like the vanity projects of, you know, Wall Street, of the types that you would expect.
Oh my God, the types of people who would have an interest in. Look at this shit.
Yeah.
Communism is small dick energy. If that's not projection, I don't know what is.
You just have to imagine who are the people who would be interested in astroturfing independent conservative media. And I mean, because that was the thing, is that like these things used to exist, you know, under their own market value, but have since had to sort of go under the conservatorship. People like Dan McDonough, who's Philly Weekly writer we're going to talk about a little later. You know, guys like this, you know, just Wall Street ghouls, you know, who have like probably like read Bernays or something and have decided, you know, that they need to be out there manufacturing consent, like, you know, like Sam Adams did or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always the best thing about, you know, reading these, like Joy Pullman, but also Kyle Salmon, and, you know, the people that we're going to continue to sort of follow closely in conservative media, who, you know, under their own, you know, market forces, you know, would just wither in the wind.
There's a mass exodus of restaurant workers occurring throughout the country right now, and who can blame them? COVID sent everyone working in the restaurants home, and when it was time to reopen and hire everyone back, a lot of restaurants found they couldn't hire enough people to fill their staffing needs. And so workers had basically left for other industries, or basically decided to give a giant middle finger to their former employers. And
yeah, I can't, anybody who could get out of the restaurant industry last year did.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's basically that simple.
Yeah.
And if you, when you add to that, you know, that the pay is generally shit, or if it's not, then the work is brutal.
Yeah. Right? Not to mention that there's no other benefits. I mean, they're not getting health insurance dental or vision insurance in any of these cases. So
now, I was laid off from a serving job last year,
mm-hmm.
that did offer, you know, these types of benefits, but you know, I mean, that only lasted for a matter of months after everyone was laid off in March, you know, and I think it's hard. I mean, for me personally, you know, to be like, oh, I want to go back, you know, to something that I, you know, ultimately hate doing for, you know, when I've basically reestablished my income in other places. And I think that that's the really fucked up thing about how restaurants end up talking about this stuff, and like restaurant owners, and even, you know, small business owners in general, right? Is it's like, you know, your labor force was sent a clear signal that this thing that has happened and is going to continue happening and still isn't done happening puts our employment and livelihood completely at risk. And mm-hmm. so, you know, so you don't go back. right? You find other things to do, right? If you can, you know?
Right.
And I think that, right, none of them are sitting at home drawing unemployment, because let me tell you a secret, right? The unemployment benefits aren't great when you're a server, right? Mm-hmm. If they even are available to you at all, right? I had been working for a company for over 6 months when I was laid off, and the state said that they only owed me the equivalent unemployment benefits to $1,000 of wages, right? I'd worked more than 40 hours there a week for 6 months, right? But they were only calculating my unemployment benefits out of $1,000, right? Which, considering I had another income source at that point, was essentially, you know, nullified.
Yeah.
To the extent that it would have existed at all, right? And I think that a lot of restaurant owners have been out of one side of their mouth saying, oh, please come back to work, right, to all these people who don't want to work for them for a myriad of reasons. And out of the other side of their mouth, they've been talking all this shit about how, oh, we need to pull back these unemployment benefits because all our workforce is fucking lazy and sitting at home, right? Which just isn't true. Unemployment numbers, claims are falling month over month, right? If there were all these people if all these people were just sitting at home filing for unemployment, we wouldn't be seeing that, right? Mm-hmm. But the hiring problem is because the signal was sent loud and clear that anybody who works for a restaurant is, and always was, but certainly is now, you know, just completely and utterly disposable.
Restaurant owners or whoever would go into like a group or forum and post like, hey, you know, we have these openings and stuff like that. And people would comment and say, well, pay us this much money. And they would say, no, we can't afford to do that. And then they would fire back and say, well, then you can't afford to be in business. So, and it's, I don't want to like sit and say like, oh, wow, like how has it taken us this long to finally get to this point where like, I mean, it really does seem like there is a turning point going on to me in terms of like workers in this particular industry kind of like having a little more power, sort of.
I think it's, you know,
they're panicking. I mean, the restaurant owners are panicking.
I think it's optimistic, you know, to kind of look at it that way, because I think that in my neighborhood, there are basically programs that can, you know, if you're willing to be a restaurant that does that, right, that you can scan a QR code and you can order and pay, you know, straight from your phone, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's just a runner, right, that drops food off at your table, right? And I think that these are the sort of processes that were already underway in the, you know, in the service industry, right, is that instead they're just going to automate, right? That you can automate that side of you know, the sector. And meanwhile, what it does to the people who used to work those jobs is I think not that they become, that their power appreciates in the marketplace, mm-hmm. but instead they transfer now more into the gig economy, right? Where
right.
you end up teaching at a university as an adjunct and driving Uber, right? Instead mm-hmm. of having employment at a company that offered you health insurance benefits, right? Mm-hmm. You know, now for a lot of people that ends up fitting a certain lifestyle a little bit better. There's plenty of time for podcasting in that situation. But I think that, you know, at the end of the day, what you've really become, you're just more vulnerable, right? Mm-hmm. But everybody who could make themselves, you know, comfortable while remaining relatively safe has basically done so, you know, and I think that's much more common.
Yeah.
And I think that the other thing, you know, that I can't, you know, drive home enough is that this is still going on, right? We're still amidst a pandemic that's going the wrong way, you know, and we are
pandemic of the unvaccinated.
Yeah. And
at this point.
And it's going to, the variants and the strains are going to continue, right?
Yeah.
Until we can reach, you know, the point where they stop doing that.
Well, the most staggering part of this whole thing as we like, you know, it really felt like, I want to say maybe in the spring, I was kind of optimistic thinking, oh man, like we're kind of really starting to turn a corner with this like vaccination rate and stuff like that. But now that we are in, you know, we're almost to August, it's clear that, I don't know. To me, it's like, was that like just like a fucking mirage? I mean, I don't see it as much in the Midwest, but at least in the South right now, I mean, it's just, it is the Delta variant running absolutely wild. And something I kind of talked about in our notes here is that, you know, there are several children's hospitals in the South that are at capacity with pediatric COVID patients. And a lot of them are children on ventilators. And I know like in Arkansas Children's, supposedly, I mean, children have more children have died like in their intensive care unit. So I mean, that's I don't really know how they, I mean, they're literally offering to pay people like $100 to just get the vaccine in certain areas and regions. I don't know how. Yeah, they should. At this point, 100%, they should pay people, because I don't know how else to convince. It's just such a fall from, you know, you hear and read about everyone like lining up in like the 1950s or 40s or whatever to grab, you know, to get your polio vaccine, and polio doesn't fucking exist in the United States.
I think that we significantly underestimate how authoritarian and indoctrinated the people of that society were. When people when Walter Cronkite got on the TV and told you how it was, I mean, that's tin pot dictator stuff just directed by the oligarchs.
Yeah.
Right. And so, yeah, everybody went and got in line because there was this social trust that was admittedly obtained by these highly managed PR organs.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they lined up and got their vaccine the same way they will in China.
Yeah.
Right. And we underestimate this about the place our grandparents grew up, that it was a highly regimented, highly militarized, highly propagandized, and highly indoctrinated society.
Because it was much easier to do that then. And, you know, the flip side nowadays, obviously, is, okay, we have the internet. So it's much easier. It's much easier if you have the tools and the resources at your disposal to break out of that mold. A lot of people don't have that, you know, based on the situation they grew up in. But
capitalism necessitated the creation of media organs in a market,
mm-hmm.
because there was profit to be made there. There were goods to be sold, and there were, you know, opinions to be sold, and all of these sorts of things, right? You know, the United States of even, you know, just 70 years before everyone lined up in the 50s to get, you know, the polio shot or whatever, that even 70 years earlier was more similar to where we live now.
Gosh, I mean, right? I've been like using that example in conversations with people, and this is not a factor I have considered in why everyone like went and got like the polio vaccine, for example. And it makes sense. It does make sense. Well, I want to just real quick, like, mention that Reddit comment I saw that just grabbed me. And I think it was, I don't remember what post I saw it under, but the comment read, "I'm starting to feel like the dog from the This Is Fine meme. I know it's not fine, but the emotional burnout is real. And the kicker here is, glad I kept all of our masks for wildfire smoke, even after we all got vaccinated." And somebody commented below saying, "Downright dystopian." Like that right there, if that's not the end game, I don't know what is. Here's my problem. The media has kind of led us to believe a little bit like, oh, if we do these things, you know, then then we're gonna be just fine. Like that's like the attitude they're trying to push forth. That isn't like, you know, too doom and gloom, but like I really do think, unfortunately, as being pessimistic in this particular topic, that the doom and gloom is very legitimate and is going to happen. You know, it's just at this point, it's about mitigating some of the damage that's going to occur in, you know, within the doom and gloom. But I don't know how we convince the entire human species that is incredibly factionalized to get on board within 10 years. It really is probably like 10 years that we have to just radically change our energy grid, how we, you know, we travel, our eating habits, all of that. Like, it's just, none of this is going to change within 10 years. And to think that we're going to like completely and radically alter that structure, I mean, it's just, it's not going to happen. I think, you know, yeah, I mean, what are some major things that are going to happen within the next 20 years? Yeah, I mean, we're probably all going to be driving electric cars. Maybe not all of us, but I mean, like, the only cars being sold are going to be electric cars. Like, that is probably going to happen. But beyond that, like, that alone is not enough to change, you know, how we do this stuff. How are we going to figure out how to, you know, convert aircraft engines into, you know, electric engines? And it's just the other thing we have to consider here is that to really tackle climate change, you know, in changing our habits, has to be like getting rid of the combustion engine and using something else. And we don't, that whatever that is, as we've talked about, is not available to the public right now. And I don't know when it will be. And so that's like, I don't know how we act in a manner that is timely and efficient to prevent hundreds of millions of people, perhaps billions of people, from dying from climate related disaster. Because at this point, it will happen, and we're gonna see it. We're gonna see it in our lifetime. It's just a matter of when. I think it's going to be a lot more soon than what like people are saying. In the uninhabitable Earth. I mean, he's talking, you know, 2050, 2060. But I mean, that book came out in 2019. That's based on research, you know, from, you know, two decades prior to, you know, to the book being released. And I just don't foresee. Let me put it this way. I think it's going to be another one of these instances where we're realizing, like, oh crap, you know, the snowball effect has started, you know, started far more earlier than we originally thought.
But here's my question for you: is, would someone be justified then in dismantling or sabotaging the equipment used to continue to perpetuate that reality?
Because
obviously there have been eco-terrors.
There have.
Weather Underground springs to mind, the Earth Liberation Front, Earth First, etc., right? But these are pretty few and far between and ineffective, and very swiftly and clearly defined and made illegal, right? And illegitimate, right? In the 20th century, you know, back when these were much more abstract concerns, right?
Climate change will go through the bureaucratic process as much as capital like is going to allow it to. Like, capital will never allow it. It will do everything in its power to prevent potential grassroots organizations from like basically like militarizing, you know, to save the earth from, you know, utter destruction. And
would they be morally justified in organizing to do so?
I don't know how to answer that question, because like, you know, the part of me is like, what I just said, that whole spiel there, was basically me saying like, radical drastic action has to basically happen within 10 years. And so, and like that, I think we can both agree, like, that's not coming. Like, we're not, so it's, you have to ask, obviously, like, okay, to save the planet and the species and like to mitigate, you know, also the damage of what is probably going to be the sixth great mass extinction event, what needs to be done? And like, is there a legitimate question in asking like, oh, should like eco-terrorists, you know, like burn down all of ExxonMobil's facilities and, you know,
I think you can make an argument that it would be ineffective to do so.
I'm not advocating for like eco-terrorists to go in and blow up. Yeah, I don't want them to blow up, you know, some facility with, you know, a bunch of just engineers that work there that, you know, don't really have any sort of social awareness of what they're doing. Like that's not necessarily what I'm wanting them to do. Yep. So it's like, where is the middle ground there?
I want to just simply point out this, which is that there is a significant disconnect between the way that liberals even will talk about the impending climate disaster, right, and the types of solutions that they're willing to pursue.
Yeah.
Right? And they'll really play up the challenge of climate change, right, when they need to keep Republicans out of office, right? They'll call them Nazis bent on destroying the planet. But as soon as they have your vote in the box, it's cap and trade and child tax credits. And yet, if you took them at their word, wouldn't they have an obligation to take more drastic actions? Especially as our political instruments prove unable to turn the tide away from crisis. And that there's top to bottom, from people who take it very seriously, people who take it seriously but are sort of reformist and pro-capitalist, and all the way over to the right, where if, you know, there is just this absolute removal between the methods that are deemed acceptable, mm-hmm. and the stakes that we're perceived to be facing. Yeah. And I think that every single person has to grapple with that, right? And come to grips with the fact that by the end of our lifetimes, it is going to be very, very, very clear where the engineers at ExxonMobil stood and what they should and shouldn't have known.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. And yeah, and that and I think that people need to get right with themselves.
I still stand behind the idea that a lot of these people like just don't care. And it's, you know, and it's, I guess that's probably the better way to clarify what I meant earlier. Okay. So they don't care to like sort of engage in thinking outside of the ExxonMobil box, basically. And that's the challenge. And I don't lay all of the blame at their feet, because, you know, these are people who are, their thinking is a product of their environment they grew up in, and it's the environment they continue to live in. Because, you know, they may not have ever been exposed to, again, thinking outside of the ExxonMobil box. But you can also argue that people nowadays have the ability with the internet and all of that to engage and challenge themselves, challenge their beliefs, but they don't. So I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that's the other thing, is once you get into like, well, people could so easily, you know, have this information as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's this guy called Kyle Salmon, right? With two M's and an I and an N somehow. And he's a right-wing blogger.
Kyle Salmon.
Yummy. I'm assuming it's not Samin. Because he's a bespectacled white man.
And then, well, Kyle, if you're listening, you can just shoot us a message on Twitter and tell us how to pronounce it.
Let us know, Kyle. So he's a right-wing blogger at the Conservative Philadelphia Weekly. as well as for the Federalist and the National Review, right? So he does the whole tour. Right?
So I was not aware. I know the Federalist and the National Review, but I did not know what Philadelphia Weekly is. I'm going to look this up.
Yeah. So this is used to just be a weekly in Philadelphia that got bought by this Wall Street investor, Dan McDonough.
Yeah, right. Here it is right here. The city of Philadelphia's leading alternative source for local news. There it is. Yeah, right
the
there.
Alternative.
The alternative newspaper of Philadelphia. There we go.
And you know, it's kind of interesting to sort of see conservative media go independent, right? Because, you know, these are folks who, you know, bear the genealogical mantle for the people who have spent most of history judging others, you know, from the comfort of the majority, and who have found themselves on the other side of the neoliberal culture war. So Salmon, and this was just wild to me, the Federalist has a paid writer, this Salmon fella, who is reviewing Rick and Morty, like episode by episode, in like an old fashioned way, like not like literally like here's what happened, you know, here's, you know, blow by blow, here's how it relates to the past episodes, and here is, you know, my conservative analysis of this show, right? And it's pretty easy. Like Dan Harmon's a pretty conservative guy. Like it's pretty easy to sort of, you know, watch it from that lens. But you can read all of his super mediocre reviews of the new season of Rick and Morty that's, you know, come out this summer. But the episode that we want to talk about is the one that he reviewed, which is about a hive mind superhero based on Captain Planet, who ultimately threatens the world with eco-terrorism as perceived by creator Dan Harmon's impression of, you know, 20-somethings and their view on environmentalism. Salmon immediately at the top of this review of this particular episode that's about eco-terrorism breaks that old like screenwriter's rule, which is you shouldn't mention like a better movie or like remind the audience of a better movie than the movie they're currently watching. And so he references this Sonny Bunches article from 2019. It's a WAPO op-ed about the Marvel series, right? And Bunch is like a conservative Hollywood critic, right? And he wrote that environmentalists, you know, make good movie villains because they want to make your real life worse, right? And it says, keep in mind, it doesn't say eco-terrorists, right? Like, and so that's like the point of departure we have to keep in mind, is that the quote that this critique of a eco-terrorism episode of Rick and Morty is ultimately drawing off of this other statement, which just says flatly in that environmentalists.
Yeah, he's equating the two terms. Yeah. He's right. Equating the two terms.
Salmon is doing that. Bunch is doing that. Isn't doing that. Bunch is literally saying that the people who want to, you know, make you drive an electric car, or, you know, switch over to, you know, non-renewable resources, or even just make you recycle some plastic, right? That these are the that they are Thanos, right? That AOC and Greta Thunberg and all of these people, right? And it's Salmon here who is sort of putting that into the context of a critique of eco-terrorism, right? Which is a much lower bar than Bunch took on in the Washington Post, right? So we've already kind of discussed like this like logical disconnect between, you know, the view of climate change and what we think we should like, you know, sort of do to fight it. But for the most part, like for people, you know, who are imagining the real life inconveniences of what the environmentalists want, so not the rare eco-terrorists, but just the environmentalists, right? It's just like, you know, conservatives bemoaning, you know, the infringement on their sense of personal liberty on, you know, the one hand, you know, and then on the other hand, we have literal actual, you know, eco-terrorism, right? Yeah. And so, you know, but taking them at their word, right, that environmentalist methods, you know, want to make your life, you know, are there to make your life worse, right? What they're mostly upset about are just sort of like the individualistic, you know, liberal placebo about reducing individual contributions to environmental deterioration and making companies pay to pump millions of tons of carbon into the air. Salmon, in his review of this episode of Rick and Morty about eco-terrorism, which is published on The Federalist, which should tell you about all you need to know about the market forces that are at play here. Salmon writes, like Captain Planet, Planetina is grounded in a form of environmentalism from an earlier time. This is no Greta Thunberg or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez lecturing about carbon emissions. Planetina has the green vibe many of us remember from those days. Picking up litter, fighting acid rain, recycling, and saving cute animals. It's a throwback to a hopeful environmentalism that was compatible with human life. And so what he's describing, of course, is, you know, the, you know, give a hoot, don't pollute, you know, late 20th century version of environmentalism, which was practiced, you know, by hippies and, you know, new left folks, right? Who were just waiting to professionalize and homeown and ultimately quit all this pinko commie shit. And they, you know, they sure did trot out a lot of slogans along the way, which Salmon is evoking fondly here, but which they'd ultimately undermine when they took a job in the oil sector. Salmon goes on, he writes, Planetina reciprocates Morty's feelings for her, but is limited by her superhero duties and constrained by the public relations image developed for her by her teen creators, who are now middle-aged and cynical. And so as soon as, you know, Morty helps Planetina free herself from, you know, the control of her now middle-aged, cynical, money-grabbing teen creators, right, the hippies and the hippies and the new left people who Salmon is remembering fondly, after she's after, you know, this fictional superhero has been freed from their control, Dan Harmon has this character immediately like kill like 300 coal miners or something, right? Like, and like Morty like helps do it. And all of this sort of stuff. It would be like twice as many people who as have ever died from eco-terrorism ever, you know. Like, but all, you know, here just sort of in unceremonial hyperbole to all to allow the comfortable suburban conservative watching Rick and Morty to take home the message that Salmon tees up for us, which is that driving each other to be ever more extreme, the radical fringe loses sight of the goal of environmentalism. Instead of wanting to preserve this planet for all humanity, they start talking as if humanity is the problem. To save the Earth from humanity rather than for it leads necessarily to actions against humans. Really sustainable living requires the contemplation of trade-offs and side effects. But superheroes, they're supervillains, don't have to think about that stuff.
Oh my God. Like, he basically says the answer, you know, it's obvious, you know, it's obvious. He says the answer to, like, why are we in the current situation that we're in, you know? It's so funny to watch them, like, dance around the answer, because they're clearly incredibly uncomfortable, I think a lot of them are, with, like, this reality. I mean, it's going to be... like, kind of going off on a little bit of a tangent here. Like, I'm going to be really fascinated to see how conservatives react to, like, just the fucking horror that climate change is going to just, you know, it's just going to dump on us. Because it's their reactions, like, at a certain point, there will come, like, there will be a breaking point in which, like, the public, I think, kind of realizes, like, okay, you know, these, you know, conservatives, neoliberals, whoever are, you know, giving bullshit answers to, you know, that drought that, you know, that killed, you know, not 100 people in the Pacific Northwest, that, like, you know, the one that just happened, but instead, you know, that heat wave that killed, you know, 5,000 people last week in Oregon or whatever, like, you know, at what point are they going to be able to, you know, continue to dance around something like that? And right. There will come a point where they will not be able to. They just won't. Because they're going to try to, and it's going to come off as so fucking absurd. You know, and the people who are just dying in the streets, you know, reading this on their iPhones, you know, are going to be like, you know, that's bullshit. should talk about Joy Pullman. Demons.
I want to like point out that these two articles that we're about to talk about from Joy Pullman are about like mental illness and like this, you know, dissociative identity disorder and all this sort of stuff. But the reason I like them is because they're a part of this other genre of conservative blog that I absolutely love, which is when they admit that they believe in, like, in their everyday lives, like demons and devils are like there and like, you know, communicating with them and their friends. And you realize, like, you know, the sort of world that that they're sort of occupying on a daily basis. And like, to give you, like, if you want to view into this,
I want Joy Pullman to read the Mothman Prophecies and just let her go fucking crazy.
You need to read Rod Dreher's 2018 and then 2019 pieces in the American Conservative about his friend Nathan, right? Which I think it's just him, right? But anyway, his friend Nathan,
whose wife was allegedly possessed by a demon,
right. So, and they are absolutely perfect, because Nathan's wife in these columns, right, has been quote unquote in the care of an exorcist, right, which I thought was a very precise choosing of words, for over a year by the time Dreher's writing this in 2018. And I mean, just imagine your wife is having a blatant affair, right? But you're such a fucking dope that not only you believe that cover story, but you tell your friend Rod Dreher, who also believes it, and writes a straight-faced column about the presence of demonic possession in the everyday life of Americans, right? And so we need to – I just want to say, like, I'm not, you know, like, I'm not reading this, you know, for any other reason than because it's a part of that universe of when, you know, people who are all about, like, you know, reason and, oh, these zany liberals you know, we'll then reveal to you the truly wacky shit that they're into. So we've got Joy Pullman here. This is the executive editor of The Federalist, for her take on mental illness and demons. last Friday, Pullman attempted to describe the conditions of the homeless population in the United States. That's my favorite thing, is that Pullman, this article starts with her describing mental illness and the homeless population, of which I only sincerely believe she has experience with one. And it's not holding a paper bag down at the street corner. Let me tell you that. So Pullman writes, "What is the core of insanity?" She's going to tell you the answer.
What a way to start that off. What a way.
It is quite simply the refusal to acknowledge or attempt to befit oneself to reality. It is imprisoning yourself inside your own mind's fantasies about what the world ought to be, what you want it to be, instead of what it truly is. This is easily apparent in any sustained encounter with America's homeless, most of whom are quite obviously mentally ill.
I can't.
It is also often apparent in any sustained encounter with someone for whom leftist politics functions as a religion.
Oh, my word. I love that the first half of that little paragraph there was basically her describing herself. In a way, too. I mean,
it's one of my favorite things conservatives will do.
I know.
But let's hold on to her assertion about, because we're going to need this at the end. Let's hold on to her assertion about religious belief and mental illness and all of these sorts of things for the duration of this, so that we can.
It's almost so insane that I wonder sometimes if these people are just being paid to write fucking satire, you know, like. I mean,
so. I think it's there to be had, but I just genuinely think that when you put yourself in the shoes of, like, who a Wall Street investor thinks a conservative is, like a down home, like conservative, like this is a rich guy's, like, if like two sort of rich East Coast people tried to imagine what like someone in middle America is like. And it's like, that is who the Federalist is for. And that's why it comes off as satire, I think. Once again, just a reference to the idea that Joy Pullman is just out there encountering homeless people in any other context other than rolling up the window to an expensive SUV. I don't think that that's happening. But anyway, one senses in all these encounters I'm having with homeless people the uncanny eeriness of having somehow entered an internally closed loop, a spiral from which there is no escape. And the assumptions underneath it are absolutely not up for question. The assumptions are many. They are often vague and undefined, and they are unquestionable. Try, and you risk being viciously attacked. Which is just, that is just how anybody at the fringe of politics feels. Because like this would all like make sense as a critique of insanity if she also weren't talking out of her mouth at the same time at like liberals. But in order to sort of make it fit, right, she's ended up just describing what people with radical politics, even herself, are like and feel like on a day-to-day basis, right? But she's ascribing the alienation of having a radical set of politics as mental illness, right, just so that she can try to dunk on the libs for it, right? Which I think it's a beautiful form of suicide.
Pullman also writes, there are also the demands that not just the unstable individual, but those he encounters be forced to conform to his reality instead of actual reality. Many kind and decent people go along with the initial demands because they seem relatively trifling and at a surface level to possibly ease another's suffering. Wear a mask. Overlook that tent pitched next to the playground. Put an unaccompanied minor into the U.S. foster care system. Once the first concession is won, however, the demand inevitably grows. Stay home from 2 weeks, 2 years to forever. Give addicts clean needles. De facto amnesty for millions. No more livelihoods for those invested in small businesses. You're a mass murdering racist if you don't comply.
Yeah, that doesn't at all sound like someone speaking from a closed ideological loop of their own ideals and beliefs.
Not at all.
Those are definitely the words of a super normal, not at all mentally ill by her definition person.
Right? Wokeness is about creating a nationwide mental hospital of forever patients who never get better. They just have to get on a new drug regimen or get centered in a different and more meaningful way. Or there's this new program they've heard about, some new place to dope up. If you take a bit much, public employees will give you taxpayer-provided Narcan, and you can be at it again the same afternoon.
You know, I'll accept that. You know, I think that wokeness, in sort of it, like to the extent that that is a stand-in for sort of effete, you know, just slightly left of central, just slightly left of center. Liberalism, right? That wokeness is kind of about creating, you know, a bunch of people who don't believe they can, you know, necessarily take an active part in like solving problems or whatever, right? And that things kind of do never get better under wokeness, right? But conservatism so far, or at least right now, seems to be about creating a nationwide regular hospital, right, with forever patients who never get better, because right now that's going to be the world that we end up living in, you know, under conservatism. And I'd rather have the mental hospital. So we say all of that, right, to sort of get this view into like Joy Pullman's definition of insanity on, keep in mind, like a Friday. Like this was like she wrote this was published like last Friday. And on the Monday, on the Monday, we have this absolute bop about how TikTok's hottest trend is as old as demonic possession. All right. And it's perfect. So it starts out, and boy, she knows how to start it. In the Bible's book of Acts, local authorities beat and throw into prison the apostle Paul and his assistant Silas for delivering a slave girl from a demon. The slave girl made money for her masters by telling fortunes, presumably using demonic supernatural knowledge. Once she was delivered of her oppression, she no longer made her masters money. So they roused up a mob to get the local magistrates to retaliate against Paul and Silas for their act of deliverance.
Quite simply, people with dissociative identity disorder express multiple personalities, sometimes with great variation. The different personalities have different names, interests, ways of talking, and gender identities. DID used to be known as multiple personality disorder. Not surprisingly, people typically develop this disorder due to sustained abuse.
Abuse carried out mainly by conservatives in home and at church, mm-hmm. and by their offspring at school.
Yeah. During which they disassociate from the horrors being perpetrated on their bodies.
Often, such people refer to themselves using plural pronouns, Pullman writes, or as a mix of single and plural pronouns, just as demons did in the ancient world. Here we go. Famously, when Jesus Christ asked a possessed man his name, he replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." That puts the pronoun struggle in a new light, doesn't it?
Oh. They're all possessed. The non-binaries are possessed.
As one would expect, if demons are involved, there it is. Many people afflicted with this disorder strenuously deny that it's demonic or even a problem, just like the man who called himself Legion before Christ delivered him. Some are seeking not to reintegrate their personalities into one whole person through therapy, but to normalize and glamorize being possessed of up to hundreds of personalities. Others, dangerously bedazzled by all of this, are playing at having the disorder to gain attention.
Oh.
So keep in mind that on the Friday, Pullman told us, what is at the core of insanity? It's simply the refusal to acknowledge or attempt to befit oneself to reality. It is imprisoning yourself inside your own mind's fantasies about what the world ought to be, what you want it to be, instead of what it truly is.
I mean, it's a 2,000-year-old loop that has been incredibly effective at keeping people quite indoctrinated for a long time and operating within its box.
And this is sort of where I think we get down to the brass tacks, right? Is Pullman writes, proponents of normalizing this disorder employ the same mental rails that helped mainstream homosexuality and gender dysphoria. At several points in the last 6 years, I have had the eerie feeling that the gates of hell were being reopened to unleash another level of human torment. This is another such moment. The multiple personalities disorder itself seems to emanate straight from hell, whether you take that literally or metaphorically.
Hmm.
And so, you know, and I think that this is where we can kind of see what this is about, right? Is that the homosexuals and the gender dysphoric, right, have managed to sort of make themselves a part of the moral majority, right? And they have been a people historically abused by the type of Western traditionalism that Pullman is, you know, a partisan of. And so we have a, you know, a conservative who's sad that they've had to remove their foot from the neck of a marginalized people, right? While they, you know, themselves fear the boot more than anyone else. This is an independently produced podcast. You can support us by subscribing and help us make more episodes by going to our Patreon page. We'll see you next week on COINTELPRO. Which, you know, anyway, I feel like if you insist in your professional bio that you're a happy wife, you have a better than zero chance of having an affair with your exorcist. Anyway.